We all have misattunements, but when we're present, sometimes we can have a misattunement with our words or our tone of voice, but we may not have a misattunement of our body. So we're missing that one element when we are remote.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Cindy Palman. Dr. Palman did her medical education here at the University of Pennsylvania, and then she did her residency training at Yale University. She always maintained a dream of becoming a psychoanalyst, and moved out west to the West Coast here in the States, to Oregon. Life challenges and sudden tragedies interfered with that goal, at least for a while, and she devoted herself to becoming a psychiatrist and a therapist both, while raising her two children. After a long time, longer than she would have imagined, she got connected to a mentor of hers, and the mentor challenged her to pursue this dream of hers, to become a psychoanalyst. And to her benefit, and the benefit of the psychoanalytic community, and certainly to her patients, she followed that dream, as you will hear in today's conversation. Dr. Palman is a third-year candidate at the Oregon Psychoanalytic Institute, and she has been in training both before and now during COVID. And she will share with us what her experiences are, both before and during COVID, and what that's been like for her, her community, and her patients. The importance of a mentor experience, I know, has been the case in my life and has been for many of the people I've spoken with on this podcast series. When you dig deep into their past, they will bring forward the presence and the importance of a mentor who helped them through difficult times. It was a pleasure for me to talk to Dr. Palman. She is numerically a candidate, but in all senses of the word, she is a clinician and a colleague. And I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Here is my conversation with Dr. Cindy Palman. Cindy, welcome to the podcast. Cindy, we've all had the experience of going through the challenges of learning how to practice psychoanalysis. In the best of times, it's a daunting task. It's a unique opportunity, in some ways unlike anything else in the world, to immerse yourself in the intimate inner life of another person, where you become part of their passions. You struggle with them as there is confusion between the past and the present. And you will, at times, find yourself in the midst of syntonic mutual misattunements that leave both people confused. And the best way that we have figured out to help one learn those experiences and learn from them is to oneself have the experience as Anna Lassand, to share one's passions with another person, to learn what it means to be confused about the past and the present, and to suffer through confusing and at times painful mutual misattunements. There used to be a saying, still true, that the best way to learn analysis is on your back. And that's in the best of times. And what helps one get through this is a sense of community. And now the community's changed, even insofar as being able to attend national meetings. I remember them well, where you would be in rooms with hundreds, if not thousands, of colleagues. And you'd walk around and you'd see people whose books and articles you've studied. And you would go through an idealization of them. And you would spend time with colleagues and you'd have dinner with friends. And you had a shared sense that everyone together is going through this learning trajectory. And locally, hopefully you belong to an institute with a supportive faculty where you have a sense that they have your back and you would be present with them. Likewise for classmates. All that's changed now. And ultimately, it's one's own experience as Anna Lassand and one's own experience as an analyst with Anna Lassand through which you learn this craft. And even that's changed. Even that is now at a remove. With all that daunting set of challenges, can you start us off, Cindy, by sharing with us what your experience is like now as a candidate?
Sure. Thank you. It was different in the spring than, and we are in progress, and I think it's actually in transition now in the fall. Because in the spring, there was this abrupt change and abrupt loss, and there was a lot more heightened fear and a lot more unknown. And I think, not just for me, but I got the general atmosphere from my classmates and my supervisors and faculty, that we wanted to keep things going. We didn't know what that meant. And so we only knew how to do it the way we've always done it, but now remotely. And so I think that was great in the short term. But now we're having more time to ask ourselves, what does this mean? How do I work best? What's different? And so I think there was a little bit of a rush to get things in place, find a technology, find a way of supporting our patients and supporting the analytic work. And I think that at least for me, what I recognized is that supporting me was third, like supporting myself. Mm-hmm. Because we have so much invested in both our patients and the work. And that gets confused. So we wanted to kind of keep it going and make it work. And that was okay. And we so, like, I noticed in the beginning, there was a lot of focus. I was always on the lookout for loss and reactions to this abrupt loss of the office. And that was huge. And my patients talked about that a lot. My loss took longer to recognize in terms of what losing the office meant to me and losing my classmates and losing kind of the whole in-person experience, my analyst, my supervisors, everything. And I think, as my school year started, was approaching for classes to start up again, I found myself dreading going back to classes because it wasn't the same thing. I couldn't face another year of Zoom. And I started talking with my classmates, and more to different degrees, we shared that. And so we then started sharing it with faculty and kind of brainstorming, what can we do different? My institute only does in-person learning, so it doesn't have the experience maybe that some others do having remote training. And the faculty were really open to what can we do? And I think that's where we are now. It's a work in progress. We used to have all of our classes on Friday afternoons, and we've now split the schedule, so it's not as tiring, allowing a little bit more room for discussion. And I think faculty and us, the students alike, are trying to figure out how do we create a community and a connection when we're not in the same room. And that's the part that I mourn the most. I think I'm a very oral as an auditory learner and a very embodied learner. Physical presence is really important to me. I read voraciously as all my life and as a child, but that was for pleasure and for escape. And all of my learning experiences in college and beyond have been through speaking with people or being present with people. Hmm. And so it's been a rough, hard transition in that sense. I find things missing, and I find other things might be more present. But I have questions. How do we create a field when we're not physically present? Can it be created?
We're all struggling with that. Just to set the stage, you're now a third year candidate, and you had spent the first year or so in pre-COVID life when everything was present, physically present.
Right, just a little over a year and a half.
So you started cases present, and your analysis was present, and your classes was present. And so you've experienced the difference between presence to remote, as have your patients, though you've also started patients entirely remote. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I started working with one person in analysis that I've never met in person.
Hmm. And how large a class are you part of?
We started out as 8 and became 7, and now we're sort of 6.5. Someone is on a temporary leave. So right now we're down to 6, but we'll be back to 7 again. So smaller. Portland's a small institute.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that in sharing your experience with your classmates that there's a commonality to the experience?
Yes, I think so. I think... For most of us, we are struggling with what's the same, what's different, how do we manage it. A lot of people have, children at home, so there's that kind of complication. I know we definitely feel that in terms of our class time. We miss sort of the off to the side and in between interaction that... kind of is a bonding. It could be over what are you eating for lunch, but there's a way that we create community and sort of support there. It's kind of a way of confirming that collectively shared space that
yes.
I think
yes.
as a field wherever it is, and when we're online we have the mind part of that shared space but not the body. And what does that mean?
Well, help us with that. What does that mean? What has that meant for you?
So in some ways, it's made my analytic work, my training, easier because it has separated my body from being in the same room as another body. So I don't get as frozen or paralyzed. I don't have as many physical reactions with my patients that might inhibit me or just make me kind of lose my mind. So in some ways it's easier for me with my patients. And at other times it's harder because I'm not necessarily sensing really what's going on with them. And I think certainly that's, I find that in my own analysis, I miss that physical presence. I ask myself almost on a daily basis whether or not it's impossible to have an unconscious conversation over the internet.
It's the topic has been discussed from many vantage points, but I've never heard that phrase quite like that. It's really quite succinct. Can you have an unconscious communication over the internet? I love it.
Because something that you said just kind of, you were talking about misattunements.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously we all have misattunements, but when we're present, sometimes we can have a misattunement with our words or our tone of voice, but we may not have a misattunement of our body. Huh. And so we're missing that one element when we are remote. And so I just think it's kind of like one more arm, and that we don't really know nearly as much about.
So the opportunity to feel frozen that you mentioned earlier by being present, and you said in some ways it's easier for you, but you're also saying that you mourn the loss of that informative experience for both of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. You know, and there were so many other things my patients mourned that I realized later that I was mourning the same thing. Like, you know, they have rituals. There's transitions on their way to my office, on their way leaving. They leave things in my office. There's a separation. But when their home is where they see me, then things can't be left as readily in my office until the next time that we meet. And so that goes true for me as well, where I don't have as strong of a transition between the people that I see, even between my home. I mean, I think over time it's created, you know, I've figured out where I see, where I work now, and that is my work corner, and that's always where it is. But the doorbell rings. My dog could bark.
Mm-hmm, sure.
There's the lawnmower in the neighbor's yard. So it's a different experience. And yet at the same time, I am so incredibly grateful that I actually even get to keep working, and have also been surprised and at the opposite of how well it works, how people have been able to actually use this opportunity to go to places that we may never have gotten to, or have maybe taken us quite a long time to get to. And so that's been the exciting part as well.
Yes. And people do report that, they report both how there's a remove, a disembodied, shallowness perhaps. And at the same time there, for some, there's a freedom to say things and feel things that otherwise, there was at times even a conscious reluctance to share. And people say, just as you did, that it might have taken longer, if ever, to get to certain things. And then, of course, it raises the question, what would have gotten in the way of sharing whatever the material is in mm-hmm. in the flesh? So there's always plenty to work with.
Right. And that's true. Like, so one of my patients, we'd been working for a while on my recommendation of analysis, and it was very difficult. He didn't want to do it. There were all sorts of different reasons, and we'd spent a lot of time analyzing it, and he was very aware that this was his issue. It's not that he didn't, part of him didn't want to do it, but he felt the need to resist, you know, for his own different reasons. Mm-hmm. And when we went remote, with me not being in the room where I could safely remain more of a positive, idealized, supportive person without the threat of me becoming, or even the possibility of me becoming an attacking person, he readily made the transition to analysis and has been exploring that. So, I mean, it's like, okay, would that have happened?
Hmm.
I don't know.
And hopefully there will be an end to this, and matters of the flesh between the two of you will be able to take shape and find words.
Mm. And, well, they are actually already now. So in one way, there's this retreat into a cocoon that he created to keep himself very safe. And it's a cocoon that very much mirrors one that he was in as a young child. And that was really good for a while. But then after a while of the two of us hanging out in that place together, he's now ready to start talking about it and seeing the ways that it makes him feel claustrophobic and lonely.
Hmm. Are there other clinical examples that you can share with us to give us a feel for how this transition has gone?
Yeah. Well, I want to share the difference between my work with my ongoing cases and my new case, because the one that I started remotely, because for me, that was a once again, a really important lesson.
Just to make a note here, mm-hmm. everyone should know that what you're hearing is well disguised. So
yes,
just want to make that clear.
And some of it is composites, so it's not in one person. So yes, but when I started working remotely, I noticed that about halfway through, I'd want to leave. I wasn't feeling agitated or anything. I wasn't distracted, but I just kept noticing, I'm done. I'm ready. Mm-hmm. And this happened consistently over time. And I talked to supervisors and friends. I brought it up in town halls at our institute. And it was just really puzzling. And then I finally noticed that with my new patient that I started online, that never happened. I never had that feeling. And I finally realized it's because with all the other people, I had a profound sense of loss. And this goes back to paying attention to their loss and not as much mine. And then I realized, oh, okay, that no matter what we're talking about, there's still this pervasive background of loss. And it was really important to acknowledge that. And I didn't have that loss of the shared space with a person that I've never seen in person. And so that kind of both is a personal, resonates with me personally in terms of my background of loss, but also that some things might not be on the surface, but they're still having a dramatic effect for all of our patients as well as ourselves. And so becoming aware of that just made a huge difference in that I think throughout this time, because I started with people in the office, loss is going to come up again and again at different times with them in different places. We're never kind of done talking about that sudden loss of meeting in the office.
And what's unique about it is that in its own way, it's a shared loss, not an identical loss, but a shared loss. Mm-hmm. Both parties have lost something and both parties live in danger. And that is one of the unique aspects of this crisis.
Very much so. And you know, I live in an area with forest fires, and we, because of odd conglomeration of wind condition and weather conditions, had this very rapid fire that quickly spread through the Mackenzie Valley. And so my patients and I were all at the same time living through that. We were all getting evacuation alerts on our phones, sometimes during sessions. The smoke got almost intolerable. And we're all experiencing that at the same time. So on top of the COVID crisis, then we had the wildfire crisis that made it even more immediate. And so we're living through it. And so then there's this back and forth between how important it is to acknowledge the reality out there, and then leaving room for both the outside reality and the and inside reality.
An aspect of the inside reality, perhaps the outside reality too, is patients' concern for your well-being. I'm imagining you in your office with smoke surrounding you in the office, I'm picturing it. Mm-hmm. And I'm picturing the discomforts. I'm picturing whatever meaning that has to each of you, but also whatever concern Anna Sands have for your well-being. Was that something that has played out?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, everyone for a long time in the beginning and then on and off later, start sessions with how are you?
Right, right.
Yeah. It's not one of those ones to always analyze immediately. We can get back to it if it's
sure.
got more relevance.
Sure.
But we answer the question, I am well. I can breathe. I'm okay. I had one patient who his asthma was so bad that he was wearing an N95 mask during a session, even though it's remote. So now it's remote and masked. And and that was quite unsettling.
I would think.
Yeah. And I have been sick during this time. I've had some times that I've had to suddenly call in sick for a few days. And that really raises the anxiety level for my patients of, is she okay? Does she have it?
Mm. And you would answer that straightforwardly.
I would.
Yeah, sure.
I would.
Sure. Yeah. Like you say, one can keep one's eye on both places, the realities and the internal space.
Yes. If I acknowledge the outside dangers, people were much more ready to then go and explore the inside dangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It used to be understood or misunderstood that deprivation about outside information, about the world we live in, or even aspects of oneself, is the best way to facilitate inner awareness. But I think the field is changing. My experience is certainly in accord with there are times where it's useful to share outside factual information, and that facilitates the emergence of fantasy that otherwise would be hard to get to.
Mm. So in an opposite way, one of the things that I've been thinking about remote work, partly comparing different patients, is that in some ways it allows more denial of outside reality. I am, at least in terms of the analyst, I am much more of a fantasy figure. There is less toggling back and forth between sort of my real presence and my psychic presence. I don't know what that means. Again, I've just been thinking a lot, like everyone else, is what's the difference between doing things remotely and doing things in person?
Mm. Cindy, you bring such a thoughtful ear to the work. Can you share with us a bit about your history and what brings you at this point? You're a bit of an older candidate, and what your professional trajectory has been?
Well, I'm 58, and I did the college med school residency thing earlier. I went into psychiatry to be a therapist. I was kind of on the very tail end, although by the time I finished my residency, there were very few people that were doing that. I was probably the family therapist. My father died when I was young, and my sister, my mother, and I were our nuclear family. And so my grandmother instilled being a doctor on everyone, so all the women in my generation are different types of physicians. But I think that for whatever reason, I had the ability to listen. My friends always talked to me about all their problems. I had a really positive experience in college with the college counseling services. And when I graduated my residency, I started getting some supervision because you don't really get a lot of therapy training. And I wanted to be an analyst, but because at that time I thought that was the only way I could get more training in therapy. My husband then suddenly died a year after we moved out to Oregon, and finding myself a single parent, that kind of changed my plans. I didn't have any time or availability to start analytic training, trying to parent a 4 and 7 year old, especially given my earlier experiences of having also had my father die at the same age as my children. And so I worked in a variety of settings. I worked at the University Health Center. I worked in a community counseling center. I worked in private practice. And then when my kids were moving on, going to college, I was really fortunate and had a good friend and a good mentor who allowed my dream of being an analyst to come alive again. I didn't think it was possible. I thought, oh, I'm too late. I'm more headed towards retirement. And I ended up letting it live again, come to life. And so I applied, and I really wanted an in-person community. So I live in Eugene, and I go to Portland, which is 2 hours away, for my training and for my community. And I should add, it's been the most amazing journey. And I am getting so much more out of my training than I would have had I done it years ago. And it's actually been a thrill.
Mm. Well, that comes across in talking to you offline and talking to you now online. Your immersion in the work really comes across. And it's not just with excitement, though I feel that too, but it's you're deeply thoughtful about this. It's a real pleasure to talk about cases with you. If I didn't know you were a candidate, I wouldn't know you're a candidate. I mean, you really bring the fullness of you to it. And I also note that, as I have for so many people I've spoken with, the presence of mentors in one's life, in one's training journey, is so vital. I certainly have had that experience when I was a resident. I had a mentor who really took me, allowed me to move forward through some difficult times. And so many people I've spoken with have had that privilege, and you certainly have as well. And you've had, obviously, in many ways, a difficult journey. But it is to the benefit of the people you work with and your colleagues and the field and your community that you have made this journey. And I feel privileged that you've shared it with me, and the listeners can get a feel for who you are and what this path has been like for you. And I want to thank you for sharing it. It's been a real pleasure to get to know you.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.